WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Moving Poets have returned after several years in Berlin, Germany. We catch up with one of Charlotte's most adventurous arts groups later in the program, but first...
There's 104 days of summer vacation, and school comes along just to end it. So the annual problem for our generation is finding a good way to spend it.
Like maybe...
Building a rocket or fighting a mummy or climbing up the Eiffel Tower. Discovering something that doesn't exist,
hey!
Or giving a monkey a shower.
That's the theme song to one of the cleverest, funniest, hit close to homest shows for kids on TV, Phineas and Ferb. And we start there.
Ooh, I'm going to go tell Mom, and when she sees what you are doing, you are going down, 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 down. D-O-W-N, down. Mom!
Hold up. We tried to get the star of the show on today, but he was honest when I asked him if he thought he was too young to be a guest.
Yes, I am.
So instead, we have the voice of the show's arch-villain, Heinz Doofenshmirtz.
What an unexpected surprise. And by unexpected, I mean completely expected.
He's also the show's co-creator, Dan Povenmire.
I, for one, am starting to get bored. And boredom is something up with which I will not put.
Wow. Rough room this morning, particularly in the syntax department. Well, you won't be bored, because along with the talking about Phineas and Ferb, we also promised to talk about the real reason Dan Povenmire is here.
Well, I'm watching you. And I'm in charge. Conditionally!
Okay. Wow. Mr. Povenmire's here because his yet unborn nephew has a serious and rare disease, and he is lending his support to help his sister promote awareness of hypoplastic left heart syndrome. I'd like to welcome you to Charlotte and welcome you to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Also want to welcome your sister, Dr. Tiana Povenmire-Kirk. In addition to being a mother-to-be, she's a professor of special education and child development at UNC Charlotte. How far along? Moments.
Moments.
I have 4 weeks left.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Hopefully she won't give birth during this segment.
Let's hope not. As I understand it, you began drawing, what, at the age of 2 or 3 or 4?
My mom kept stuff I drew when I was 2 that looked like a giraffe and a chimpanzee, and specifically a jaguar, not a cheetah. And I'd seen these pictures forever, and it wasn't until I had kids of my own that I realized how far advanced I was at that young age.
How do you explain that?
I have no idea. I'd never been able to not draw something. You know, there's never been something that I thought, oh, how would I draw this and make it look like that? It always just sort of comes out. So I was sort of a serious artist before, and got sort of tired of it and became this cartoonist, and it's worked out well.
But that's back in the day when you did it for fun. Now you have to do it. You have to crank it out because, I mean, this is real work.
Well, it's real work in that we have a deadline all the time, but it's about the most fun thing you can do for a living, I think. You know,
really?
when kids are saying, oh, do you think I should try to do cartooning? If kids who like to draw always ask me about the career, and I always feel like, this is the lowest stress and the most fun you can have, and people actually pay you for it.
Yeah, but my gosh, you've got to – I don't know how many episodes of Phineas and Ferb
there are. 126.
Right, that's still a lot of ideas to come up with.
Yeah, and most of those are – that's 126 half hours, so there's 11 minutes per episode. So there's really like, 252, 11 minutes or something like that.
11 minutes an episode, it's a half hour. What fills the rest of the time?
Commercials. Yes.
Are you serious? Yes. You've got to be kidding.
A half hour of TV is 22 minutes.
Exactly right.
Yes.
So there are
exactly.
Two episodes per half hour or
yes.
Two little vignettes
yeah.
per half hour?
And there are some episodes we've done that are half hour episodes, and we've done, I think, like 5 hour long specials now and a movie for the channel. So there's been a lot of stuff. When they first picked up the show, they were like, we want 16 half hours. And me and Swampy, my co-creator on the show, looked at each other and was like, that's like 32 stories. Can we tell 32 stories with these guys? And then they picked it up for 26, and then it was 39 the next season.
I always wonder about that. I mean, it's great to come up with an idea, and you can sustain it for a while, but how do you force yourself to tell all those different stories every season? You're contractually obligated
to do it.
How do you do it?
I have to show up and do it. The thing is that you know, it's sort of like, do you ever run out of ideas? It's not a finite pot that your ideas come from. Your ideas create other ideas. It's sort of a self-generating thing. And you know, writing comedy is sort of a self-generating thing. The more you do it, the more you stretch that muscle, the more – the easier it is and the quicker you can get it done.
Now, it isn't often that we have a sibling of the guest on the show. The guest usually gets away with saying whatever they want to say without anybody challenging them.
I would usually be talking bad about my siblings. Yeah. Right.
But we have your sister here with us. Yes. You say that growing up, you were inseparable, the two of you. Is that right?
I'm 11 years younger than him, and so I would...
We were inseparable until college.
Yeah. When he left for college, I think I cried myself to sleep every night for a couple months. But I was always climbing on him, and I remember... he used to get on his knees on one end of our couch, and I would come running around the other end. I wanted to be Ursa, warrior of the cosmos, and I'd have a towel up over my head, and I'd run chasing towards him.
Which was her whip.
To whip him with my whip. It was like the whip of justice. And he would just pick up one of the couch cushions when I got close enough, and I would just bounce off of it and fall down. And then I'd get up and run back around and do it. Okay, let's do it again. Let's do it again. So and we just always played. And the weird thing for me about the show is that my kids love it. That's not the weird part, but
it's weird that your kids love it.
Is that when it first became really popular, he does the voice of Dr. Doofenshmirtz, and then there were all these little Disney segments where he was being interviewed. So my brother's voice was always in the other room because the voice he does for Dr. Doofenshmirtz is the voice that he's done for most of the villains that he played when we were kids and we were playing. So that is a voice I've heard
forever.
Since I was forever.
Well, I didn't realize that until my sisters both told me that after the show was on the air.
We have two young people in the studio audience this morning, and the first thing that they said was, "Oh, do Dr. Doofenshmirtz."
Yes, I do the Dr. Doofenshmirtz voice for people whenever they ask, because it's an easy thing to do. It sounds like it would hurt my voice to talk like this, but I can do it for like 2 or 3 hours pretty consistently.
You know, as I watched Phineas and Ferb, the first couple of times that I watched it, I thought of Tom Terrific and Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog. Are you familiar with that?
I'm vaguely familiar with that. That sounds familiar from my childhood.
That cartoon ran on Captain Kangaroo, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong about that. But Tom Terrific, which is an ordinary boy, and he had Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog. And there was a villain named Krabby Appleseed, who used to say, "I'll get you, Tom Terrific, if it's the last thing I do."
I remember him.
and it reminded me of the platypus. And say his name again.
Dr. Doofenshmirtz. Dr. Heinz Doofenshmirtz from Doofenshmirtz Evil Incorporated. Yeah. I've got my own jingle.
That's what it reminded me of. What was my question going to be? Animation.
Yes.
You've been doing this for a long time. It's not just with Phineas and Ferb.
No, I was on SpongeBob. I was on Rocko's Modern Life. I was on The Simpsons way back when. I was storyboard director and director on Family Guy for many years. And
Cat Dog.
Hey, I did
Arnold.
A little bit of. I did some Warner Brothers shorts for a while. I've sort of bounced around. This was just the first show I sold.
So how do you make the transition from artist, which you are, into animator?
Well, you know, I was like I say, I was a serious artist, and I was selling art and art fairs and stuff like that. I was sort of a professional artist from the time I was about 11 years old. And I never thought about really cartooning until I saw an ad in a paper at the University of South Alabama, where I grew up in Mobile, and it was an ad for campus cartoonist contest, and I was like, oh, I could probably do that. I'm a fairly funny guy, and I can draw, and so I drew these cartoon characters, and that became a weekly strip there. And then when I went to California, I was at USC. And I did the strip daily there for many years.
That was a strip called Life is a Fish?
Life is a Fish, yes. And it became sort of my schooling on how to cartoon and how to do things in shorthand.
But you also came up with an idea to merchandise, which I think is really fascinating for a college student. You sold $14,000 in associated merchandise for that strip.
Oh, probably more. That was probably like 1 year's worth. I did T-shirts and calendars and books and stuff like that. And It became very, very popular on campus.
Are there elements of Life is a Fish that have cropped up in your later work?
Sort of the idea of how to set up a joke and pay it off. The rhythm of the dialogue is very similar to the way, you know, it's like you sort of come up with your own comedic voice.
Life is a Fish, how so?
Well, the main character was you know, because everybody had like strips like Garfield was a cat,
right,
and
right.
And Marmaduke was a dog, and I was like, what other, you know, when you're in college, the only pet you end up having is usually a fish, and I should have a guy with a pet fish, except being in a bowl would be too confining, so he floats around. Yeah. He was a levitating goldfish that we sort of made fun of.
You are, I guess artists are adventuresome because they like to try new things and push the envelope, but it seems that you've done that in your life as well because you went to, as a child, I think the two of you, am I right about this? The two of you drove to Mobile from Mobile, Alabama to San Diego. Was that another sibling?
We did it several times.
Yeah.
Yes. It was me and her and our other sister.
And you drove. The
two older siblings traded off. I think she wasn't yet old enough to drive.
I had to stay awake the entire time because I was the navigator.
Ah,
yes.
And the parents let you. The parental units let you do this.
Yeah, yeah. They were. They're horrible, horrible parents.
No.
They just let us run rampant over them all the time. Hey, we're going to California. And there's nothing you can do to stop us. No, I think it was just – I mean, she was fairly old. She was like
– 12.
Yeah, 12 or 13, something like that.
Well, you're the oldest.
Yes.
And there's a character in Phineas and Ferb of the older sister.
Yes.
And the older sister is always trying to catch
She's
Phineas
based on my slightly younger sister. We have a middle sister in between us. And she would always, you know, tell on me. Anytime she felt like I was doing something I should get in trouble for, she would tell on me. She was very gleefully.
So when she sees Phineas and Ferb today,
yeah. Well, what's funny is that actually the mom in Phineas and Ferb is based entirely on my sister now, on our sister Linda, and her name's Linda, and it's like whenever we, you know, whenever we're writing for her, I think, how would Linda say this? And when I showed her the show, she loved the character of the mom. She was like, "I love the character of the mom. That's great." It's like, and I said, "Well, you know who I'm doing there? That's you." And she laughed. I'm like, "Well, that's why. That must be why."
For those who don't know, Phineas and Ferb, the premise behind it is that these two boys, they're on summer vacation, and they've been told, they try to fill their summer vacation with adventures and discovery and
they try to do something spectacular in every single day.
Every single day. And that came from your parents, didn't it?
Yeah. It was, you know, my mom was always – my house was the house that everybody would always come over and want to visit because she always had some fun, creative thing going on. And she felt like, you know, you have all this time at summer. Let's do something fun with it. And we were, you know, building forts and doing – and, you know, we created a board game that looked like Monopoly. But our own board game, where we built the board and did all the chance cards and all that sort of stuff, and there was constantly something fun going on. And then as I got older, I bought a movie camera, a little Super 8 movie camera, with the proceeds from one of the art shows, and I would make movies. And so the house was always draped like some science fiction thing. You know, there's like black material over three quarters of the living room so that could be space and stuff. She was just always into whatever creative thing we were doing, which was really fun.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some more about the evolution of the creation of an evolution of Phineas and Ferb, and also the real reason why you are here for a special event tomorrow at the Cone Center at McKnight Hall at UNC Charlotte at 11 o'clock. We'll talk about that.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and 123NC.com, providing North Carolina with instant access to online criminal records for over a decade. Criminal records can be searched instantly online at 123NC.com. And Alpine Ski Center on East Boulevard in Charlotte, outfitting new skiers and snowboarders since 1976, hosting an annual season kickoff this weekend with new performance winter clothing and snow sports gear for 2014. Well, Tuesday, as many of you know, is Election Day. Not everybody knows this because it's an off-year election, but no matter how you vote, no matter how the vote goes, we're going to end up with a new mayor, and there are also races for city council, both district and at-large seats, for school board, and for the bond issues that are on the ballot. In this age of polarized politics, it's been pretty quiet this election season, but there are differences among the candidates and around the issues, and we'll look at them Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Apologies from the Obama administration over rollout of the Affordable Care Act website. Congressional budget negotiators meet for the first time, and the deficit falls to the lowest level since 2008.
Tune in the Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup, coming up from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Let it play. I forgot about the little bumper that comes from Phineas and Ferb, actually. Dan Poppenmeyer is the co-creator of that cartoon for kids, which appears on the Disney Channel
and Disney XD.
And you can see it, if you want to see it right now, you can go to the internet. And it's all,
on Netflix, yeah. It's on YouTube.
Yes, it is. And it's
all wonderful. Over the place.
It's wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Tiana Poppenmeyer-Kirk, his sister and a mother-to-be, and the real reason that you're actually in Charlotte, which we'll talk about in a second. One of the things I like about Phineas Ferb is the way the characters are drawn. I think that the fact that Phineas has this triangular
head.
Pointed head, and he's kind of a geeky kid in that he's always doing something intricate and detailed.
Yes.
Is that why he has a pointy head?
Well, he has a pointy head because I was sitting in a restaurant, and you know, sometimes they'll give you butcher paper instead of a tablecloth, mm-hmm. and give you a can of crayons to doodle while you're waiting for your food, and I was trying to figure out if I could even draw a character that was based on a triangle because I'd worked on several shows. And they usually start with some sort of circular-ish shape. SpongeBob started with a square. And I was like, how could I do a character that's a triangle? And I put the eyes up there. And then it's like, oh, that looks really good. And I liked it so much, I tore it out, took it home. I drew Ferb and Perry and Doofenshmirtz that night and took it to work the next day. And my partner, my writing partner, and I were trying to come up with a show that we could do on, you know, to get together on our own. And we sort of built the whole world around that.
Why the names Phineas and Ferb?
Phineas looked like a Phineas when I drew him. People ask me that. Do you know a Phineas? We do have a friend named Ferb. So
really?
Yeah. So his real name is Frank, but he's a set builder that we've known for years, and we just love the fact that his nickname is Ferb.
Is he monosyllabic?
He is not. He is a very talkative person, but he does have more tools than anybody I know. So he has that in common.
Because Ferb, this is the other thing I like, only speaks maybe once in the show.
Yeah, we thought about having him not speak at all, having him be Gromit, like in the Wallace and Gromit, or Teller of Penn and Teller. But we felt like if we give him one line, then people will actually wait and see what it is and like sort of collect those lines for what episode. And sure enough, there's a whole wiki page on what Ferb has said in every single episode.
And they have a pet platypus.
Yes.
He's also a secret agent. Why is their pet a platypus?
Because nobody had done a platypus yet. Platypuses are really strange, bizarre. You know, it's like God's little joke. You know, let me throw a bunch of things into a blender and make an animal out of it. It's got a beaver tail and a duck bill and its fur and it's a mammal. But I'm going to have it lay eggs. I'm going to have it lay eggs because just to throw everybody off.
It's the missing link, isn't it?
It is.
What he's not telling you is he's been somewhat obsessed with platypuses or platypi.
Is it true?
I don't know. As long as I've known you.
Really?
Yes.
I was not aware.
Occasionally you would just blurt out something about a platypus.
At one point, someone brought in a book, one of my old comic books from USC when I did the comic strip. And in one of the prefaces of that, it said, one of the questions I always get is why a fish? Because I had a fish in that character, in that one. And I wrote that I was actually trying to draw a platypus, and I'm just such a bad artist that it looked like a fish. And I'd completely forgotten that. But one of my artists had bought that book way back in like 1985 and brought it in, and I – and I re-signed it for him.
You're actually here in Charlotte for a very important reason. As we said at the very beginning, your nephew-to-be, as yet unborn, Sullivan, is that that's his name?
Sullivan Daniel Kirk.
You're way ahead of things.
Oh, he's named after his uncle.
Okay. Well, the child has a serious condition called hypoplastic left heart syndrome, or HLHS for short. This is your child, Dr. Kirk. You found out about this condition during an ultrasound, correct?
Yes, at 19 weeks. Everything, you know, we had a very fast ultrasound tech, and so it's like, here's the brain, and here's the stomach, and oh, yep, that looks good. And then she said, now I'm going to take a picture of the heart. And the beats just went and went and went, and I kept waiting for her to say everything was okay, and I'm looking, and it's not my first child. I've seen a few of these before, and I knew I couldn't see all four chambers of the heart, which is what they're trying to see. So then she called somebody else in, and you know, and then the next, it took about a week to find out exactly what was wrong, but we knew that it was a potentially life-threatening defect in how his heart had developed. Mm.
Had you ever heard of this condition prior to that moment?
No.
How prevalent is it?
Approximately 1 in 4,000 births, but congenital heart defects affect 1 in 100 live births. So it's not unusual to have a child with a heart defect, but it is this particular one is very complex.
Do we know the cause of it?
No. Less than 10% of all children who have HLHS have any family history, have any other associated syndromes or other associated birth defects. Typically, they are very normally developing human beings. Everything works. You know, everything else looks perfect. For some reason, the left side of his heart did not develop properly.
Yeah, talk about exactly what this is, hypoplastic left heart syndrome.
Well, hypoplastic is apparently a medical term for really, really small and underdeveloped and non-functioning. So, you know, typically the right half of your heart brings blood in from the body. The left half of your heart pumps oxygenated blood out to your body.
I thought about this yesterday. Left half, right half. Is that as we are looking out at the world, is the left side of your body the left side of your heart, or is it the other way around?
The left half of your heart is actually left and front.
Okay.
So it's the one that's closest to your breastbone.
Okay. And that feeds the body with blood.
That feeds the body and the brain. It just pumps all of the oxygenated blood out. Now, there's lungs involved in all of this, and I am not a medical doctor, so I don't have all of that. You know, if you want, there's great websites you can go to for more information. But basically, the entire left ventricle, so the top and the bottom half, you know, because there's four chambers in the heart, is severely underdeveloped. It's very small. The valves don't work, and the muscle around the outside is thickened. The heart is a pretty pressurized system, and so there's no blood flow going through the left part of his heart at all. There's a little bit of leakage, but it's not – there's no blood flow.
Well, that's the other thing I read yesterday about this, that when a newborn – I didn't know this. When a newborn is born, there's an opening between the left half and the right half of the heart, which closes in a couple of weeks.
I didn't realize.
Sometimes within a couple of days. With healthy babies, heart-healthy babies, it's within a couple of weeks. With babies whose hearts have maldeveloped, it tends to start to close sooner. And things like taking ibuprofen during pregnancy can cause that to close, which would be fatal for Sullivan. But they have to keep that open.
Open. Because as long as it's open, he's getting it's not sufficient, but he's getting blood supply to the body. But when it closes, then something has to be done. This is not a curable condition, is it?
It's not curable. It is reroutable.
Right, which is what the real situation here. This is there's several tragedies here with this kind of a condition. One is the condition itself, but then the fact that this little infant is going to face at least three surgeries in his very early life.
Three open heart surgeries.
And they do they each have to be done in a particular order, and they each serve a particular purpose. Mm-hmm. Talk about that if you can. I'm not sure you can.
Well, within approximately 3 to 7 days after he's born, he'll have a procedure known as the Fontan, and that basically puts a shunt of some kind in between the two ventricles because that It's called PDA, and the last two words are ductus arteriosus. It sounds like a Harry Potter spell to me, but I don't remember what the P stands for. But that is going to close no matter what they do. It will eventually close. So they basically are kind of replacing that to keep the blood flow between the two sides. There's a couple other minor things that they do during that procedure. It's designed basically to keep him alive long enough for his lungs to develop enough that they can do the second procedure, which is known as the Glenn. They're named after the doctors that developed
right,
them.
Right.
And the Glenn takes the outflow that would be going from the heart and basically reroutes it so that instead of coming from the heart, it's coming directly from the lungs for that oxygenated blood. So it doesn't have to come from the lungs to the heart and then from the heart to the rest of the body. And it's very developmental. If you think about infants that are between 4 and 6 months old, they're, you know, they have all this brain development that's going on. They also have, they're, you know, wiggling their arms around, they're grasping at things, they're developing some of their fine and gross motor skills, mostly from the top up. They're learning to stabilize their bodies. And so we want to ensure that they have appropriate blood flow to the upper half. And then,
the third operation.
I may have gotten those wrong.
Well, that's okay.
But okay.
You're not a medical doctor.
I'm not a medical doctor.
But you are a doctor of special education and child development. So when you think about the challenges that your child and any child who's born with this condition is going to face, you are relatively an expert in that area. What special needs will this child have going forward?
He's going to have real low oxygen saturations. Between the first and second surgery, he'll be between 75 and 80%. We want people at 99 to 100% oxygen saturation. After the second surgery, that will go up a little bit, but until the third surgery, which is around 3 years of age, it's going to be, which is where they reroute the lower half of the body. It's just a lower oxygen level. And what we know about infant brain development is that low oxygen levels or lack of oxygen can cause learning disabilities, the condition known as ADHD sometimes can cause intellectual disability, lower IQ, certainly processing disorders, all the stuff that goes on in our brain that we take for granted. I'm not as concerned about that part because I know what good special education looks like, and I know that good special education is just good education, and if we, you know, he will get the accommodations that he needs, mostly because I'm his mother. But because I have a long history of teaching teachers and working with teachers and providing professional development. So that part is less scary to me. But I do want to say I've been lecturing for years in classes about working with parents. That I believe that's the most important thing of any job of any educator, and specifically with special educators. And, you know, the good news is, having not had a child with a disability until now, you know, I came to this realization that I was right. What I was telling students was correct, you know, and going from experiences of friends and colleagues of mine who have had children with disabilities. But I was also right. The bad news is I was also right that until you've been there, you can't understand it. Mm-hmm. So I've become an expert very recently.
Right. And you said that this really has reorganized, for lack of a better term, the entire family. And you have a 17-year-old, you have several other children, ranging from 2 to 17, but the whole family in advance, in anticipation of the birth of Sullivan, has really reorganized itself.
I guess I've kind of been superwoman. I haven't been trying to be, but I've always done everything. Mm-hmm. And this has really shifted my operational paradigm, which then has trickled down to everybody else, that I can't do everything, and that, what this is going to look like. And my husband will tell you, and he tells me all the time, I'm the emotional center for our family. And I've been a little emotional lately, as you can imagine. So it's been interesting watching the kids really rally around me and rally around their little brother, who's not even here yet.
And your brother is rallying around. That's why he's here.
It's been amazing.
You are here, you know, you're a cartoonist. Your job is to have fun, and your job is to make us laugh and look at the cleverness that comes out of Phineas and Ferb and some of the other projects that you've worked on in your career. This is a whole different job that you've taken on here. But tomorrow you are going to be taking part in what is called the Phineas and Ferb Family Fundraiser. I love that. It's very alliterative. At McKnight Hall at 11 o'clock. What's going to be happening?
oh, I'm going to be drawing pictures for the kids. I'm going to draw up on the stage. I'll do the voice. I'll do tell a little bit about how the show came into being and how we make the show. I'll be signing posters and doing voicemail messages for people if they want their voicemail to have Dr. Doofenshmirtz putting people off. That'll you know.
You've reached Bill. Well, you haven't reached Bill. You've reached Dr. Doofenshmirtz because I'm taking over every cell phone in the tri-state area. Something like that. Uh-huh. And you know, but leave a message. I'll get it to him somehow.
I told my sisters that I'll just be here and I'll be their fundraising monkey for as long as they want me to be.
Because it's enormously expensive. Insurance doesn't – this is what people don't understand who don't have to face these problems. Insurance does not cover all of this.
It just covers the hospital-ish stuff. The
expenses associated with this kind of thing are astronomical. Is that going to change at all? Do you know? Because you probably haven't been able to get on the website yet under the Affordable Care Act.
No, I think, you know, the understanding that I have of the Affordable Care Act is that people will be able to supposedly afford health insurance or that everyone will be required to have health insurance. But it's not – we're not doing health care reform or a revolution. We're not looking at, you know, why do you get a bill for a $215,000 hospital bed stay? And, you know, and it's not – they're not charging that for the hospital bed. They're charging that for the bed and the nurses and the room and all of the things that happen related to the bed. But when you have a newborn that is attached to, you know, no fewer than 15 machines that are all being monitored constantly and they have a private nurse that's, you know, one-to-one just on your child, that's expensive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you do the math, the insurance covers 80%. The rest ends up being, you know, more than I make in a year. Easily for most of those bills.
Sure,
so.
Sure. Wow. I would think it's difficult when you find out about something like this. It's difficult to be funny or to think funny when you know your sister's 3,000 miles away facing this reality in her life. But the machine that is show business.
Yeah, I still have to go in and make people laugh.
It cranks on. What do you – you know, there's been a lot of animated shows on television that are – both popular with adults and children. Some of the ones that you've worked on, I think all of the ones that you've worked on actually have this dual core. And the show that we share in common as children, Bullwinkle, Rocky and Bullwinkle, was certainly for adults.
Exactly.
And for children. What is it about animation that people gravitate toward?
Well, I think animation, because the characters are sort of simplified, that anybody can put themselves into those characters. You know, it's like if you know, a photo is a photo of one person. A drawing could be almost anybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that people identify with those characters more partially because of that.
And do you actually have to do or have you actually done in the past the animation that's what 28, 29, 30 frames a second?
Yeah, I was an animator before and I draw about – you know, the episode we're working on right now is an hour long. I've drawn like 1,500 drawings for or something like that. Although I have a whole staff of artists that work underneath me. I do a lot of redrawing and reanimating to make things work. So, you know, it's you know, I go to work and I draw silly pictures and I do silly voices and I write silly songs and tell silly stories, which is all the stuff I would be doing if I was unemployed. and you know, but I'd be doing it in my house with my loser friends.
And you do so, write the music, much of the music that appears.
We write the songs.
Right.
We have a composer that does the underscore for the for the thing, but the songs we write. Because I'm a frustrated musician from my earlier days.
It's hard to believe that this took effort to get on the air. It took several meetings with Disney.
13 years. Yeah. I mean, we created it back in 1993. It didn't go on the air till 2008.
So,
and it went to all sorts of different studios.
You got to keep at it, and ultimately it pays off. Dan Povenmire is the co-creator of Phineas and Ferb on the Disney Channel, YouTube, and elsewhere. He's also in town to appear tomorrow at 11 at McKnight Hall for the Phineas and Ferb family fundraiser for her sister, Dr. Tiana Povenmire Kirk. Thanks for being here.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3, mornings and evenings, the First Alert weather team, forecast weather for the region. WBTV First Alert mobile weather app brings interactive radar and up-to-date forecast. WBTV on your side.
And the North Carolina 529 College Savings Plan, one of College Foundation of North Carolina's many services helping families plan, apply for, and pay for college. CFNC.org/NC529. Well, apologies from the Obama administration over rollout of the Affordable Care Act website, congressional budget negotiators meeting for the first time, and the deficit falls to the lowest level since 2008. Just some of the topics that a panel of journalists will take up with Diane Rehm in the first hour of the weekly news roundup, the national hour first at 10, the international hour at 11. That's all upcoming here on WFAE. And when we come back, the moving poets have moved again, this time back home to Charlotte.
Many arts and cultural organizations in Charlotte are dealing with cutbacks in funding and donations. Leaders are looking for new ways to attract community support. WFAE's next public conversation will explore the outlook for Charlotte's cultural groups and how they hope to build a stronger future. Join us for this free community forum on Tuesday evening, November 12th at Spirit Square. Details and RSVP at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. So from the creator of Phineas and Ferb and the voice of their villain, Heinz Doofenshmirtz, we go to Till Schmidt-Rempler, the man whose name I like to say. In fact, I've always said that when I've had Till on the program because I like to say his name, Till Schmidt-Rempler. He's the founder of the Moving Poets. They were once one of Charlotte's most creative arts groups until they decided to leave and set up shop in Berlin, Germany. They're still there, but they're becoming bicontinental and have returned to the Queen City. The inaugural production of their triumphal return, Moving Poets Reloaded, is underway at the Booth Playhouse. And Till Schmidt-Rempler, the company's Berlin artistic director, joins us along with Sarah Emery, the company's Charlotte artistic director, and who is also one of the dancers. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to you,
Glad
sir.
To be here.
Thank you very much.
What brings you back to Charlotte?
Oh, what brings us back to Charlotte? I guess a lot of people that we have had developed a lot of relationships with through the years, of mm-hmm. course.
Because your company is not a typical company. It's not a dance company. It is not a theater company. It is not an art gallery. It is all of those things and more. And finding you had a decent coterie of people who really supported you in that first incarnation of the Moving Poets. But really, it was like any arts group. It's a struggle, and the struggle became all encompassing. And I think that's why you
Correct.
Decided to go elsewhere.
Yeah. That is correct.
So has it been enough years? I think you left in 2006.
Yeah.
Has there been enough years for the pain and the struggle and the exhaustion to have been forgotten?
Obviously must be like that. Luckily, we do all have short-term memory. I guess otherwise people wouldn't have children. But yes, of course, it's been enough years, and there's a lot of excitement on our side
Good.
To really...
You were part, Sarah, of the original.
Yes, I was a dancer from 1998 to 2006.
And you said that I read this in some article. I read that the company had hit a plateau in finding funds and it exhausted their efforts. And you said we had an extremely small staff of artists and were trying to do much more than we could handle.
Yes.
So what's changed? How's it going to be different?
I think the way that we're approaching it this time, we just want to do a great show and see how well it's received or not. but so far it's been very well received. And just take it one step at a time and not try and do more than we have the funds or the support for.
I've said that the company was becoming bicontinental, and you've always been bicontinental. You had a career dancing in Europe, and then you came here, and at one point you were dancing for North Carolina Dance Theater, and then you established your own company and decided to move to Berlin to give it a shot, mm-hmm. Berlin, Germany. Did you go to Berlin to establish a company like Moving Poets or the Moving Poets there, or did you go to Berlin just to see what opportunities might strike you?
Well, all of the above, I would say. we did, of course, go to Berlin because it's an art city, and mm-hmm. also to establish Moving Poets there, but establish it in a different way, or give it basically more room for all the different art forms that are actually involved, always have been involved with Moving Poets. So rather than just having stage productions, and I'm not saying just that is already mm-hmm. A great thing, but we wanted to have a space that actually offers from visual artists through musicians, through writers, through dancers, actors, a possibility to work there and work with each other and try out things, and help so that everything has its own space a little bit, mm-hmm. you know.
And you were able to do that over there in 7 years?
Yes, we have like some crazy place over there that actually does that.
It's amazing that you were able to do that. You've described Berlin as a crazy, weird city where everything you can imagine can be found, which sounds like a good place for a company that refuses to color inside the lines, which is your company.
It is certainly that as well. I mean, it's not only refusing to color inside the lines. We do that as well, but we do also color outside the lines and would like to have that freedom. And I think Berlin, of course, is great with that, and also has a lot of the traditional arts and very, very good. It mm-hmm. does everything from very traditional conservative till about as far out there as you can possibly imagine. And I guess that's a good thing.
A lot of people were not here. We've had a lot of newcomers since you left Charlotte in 2006. So people may be going, what are they talking about? What's the philosophy behind the Moving Poets? What is it all about?
Well, one of the most important things is for us to create work that is meaningful for artists and audience. I think that is a very significant part. We want to bring work to an audience that they enjoy, that kind of allows them to experience new things, to be inventive, curious themselves as audience, but also for the artist, it needs to be meaningful. So it's fun for everybody involved.
And why did you want to do? I'm going to ask both of you this question. Why do you want to pursue this line of artistic expression? Because both of you are trained as dancers, and I've rarely met a dancer who was not consumed by dancing. Mm-hmm. A dancer dances, they think in terms of choreography and physical movement. They don't necessarily think in terms of spoken word. They don't necessarily think in terms of instrumentation or light design or painting, which is part of this performance that you're doing right now at the booth. Why do you feel drawn to those other aspects outside of dance?
I think for me, I enjoy the challenge of trying to combine other disciplines. I've danced my entire life, and I got to a point after I became professional, I started to get a little burnout on dance and a little bored. mm-hmm. And I quit for a little while, and then I met Till and saw what he was doing, and I thought, well, maybe that's something I could try. And it just inspired me in so many different ways.
For me, it's on the one hand just realizing that there's a lot of things, a lot of storytelling that can be done through different art forms, and combining them with each other is a wonderful thing, to say things that you can't really say so well through dance, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, acting is great for it, but vice versa, for example, dancing is great to create atmospheres and moods, but it doesn't really do well with giving you concrete information and text.
You know, Matthew Bourne is bringing his Sleeping Beauty here to town. I think it's next week. I think it is next week. And he came here earlier with his production of Edward Scissorhands, which looks like a Broadway show. I mean, it sets the costumes, the number of people on the stage, but there are no spoken words. It's all dance. So what's the difference between that and the traditional Sleeping Beauty that the dance theater might do or that some other ballet company might do, and what you do?
Oh, what's the difference? But I think what people in general, what we feel from our audience is that they're invited on a ride that they don't experience anywhere else. Mm-hmm. I think that's the best way to put it, really. It allows them to create their own worlds. We leave a lot of freedom for an audience and actually also encourage instead of us just giving everybody a manual, this is the way you got to understand this, this is the way you got to... Oh, no, there's room for you to finish the painting. And I think, in reality, we do that anyways. Everybody who comes to see an exhibition of new work or whatever, they will finish the painting. Mm-hmm. It's not the painter, it's the audience that finishes it. And it's the same here, and we encourage it, and we encourage also the awareness of that.
You're nodding at everything he's saying, Sarah. Because what you do is fairly contemporary, and it's like, I guess, in a way, contemporary art, which is open to interpretation. Sometimes I'll see something and you won't see it, but you'll see something completely different.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of a brave new world. That seems to me, as you said, the company is raw and not afraid to try new things. That's pretty brave.
I think so. It's a nice challenge. Mm-hmm.
So this first production, which opened a couple of nights ago and plays through the weekend at the Booth Playhouse, is called Moving Poets Reloaded. Why?
Well, that's exactly what it sounds like. We are reloaded. We've had Till's been doing a lot in Berlin, but mm-hmm. kind of
recharged with energy.
Exactly, recharged with energy and ready to go and trying to do some new things, maybe, you know, different from what we did before.
Although one of the pieces is something you've done before, there are mm-hmm. several pieces in this show, but one was done in 1998, which is a long time ago, mm-hmm. called Contact. You're the choreographer mm-hmm. on this piece. Talk about Contact.
Well, Contact is a celebration of art through different elements, like on the one hand Oscar Wilde's essays on art, The Critic as Artist, and The Decay of Lying, which is very satirical in one way, but also very serious and beautiful, has a lot of depth. It goes, sends you through a lot of different roads. And I think it's very much about that the ability of art to create worlds that can't be created in any other way, and that there's a beauty and wonder of art that makes it all worthwhile. I think that's what it's about.
And really. This piece truly is... multidisciplinary.
Yes, it is.
Because you have dancers, and then you have a story being told by an actor, Robert Lee mm-hmm. Simmons, and then you have a Vietnamese painter who lives here locally. I'm going to say his name incorrectly, so you can say it first.
Yi Nguyen.
Thank you very much. and he's painting. What exactly is he painting?
Well, actually, it's Yi Nguyen and Lee Baumgart okay. that are painting. And, well, what exactly they're painting? They decide right there on the spot. On the one hand, they do paint the artists and the set, the stage, uh-huh. and they paint also real beautiful, big paintings. And they have no time to do it. It's kind of...
About 15 minutes.
about 15-20 minutes, really, to do a 4x6 painting. They can include the dancers in case they move by the painting.
I mean, they'll actually paint on the dancers?
Well, and they will use the dancers to do the painting also. It's a lot of fun, and it's phenomenal what gets out of it.
And you've had, yes, you've had rehearsals for this, and you've had a couple of performances under your belt. So have the pictures that have come out of these performances and rehearsals been different every time?
Well, The open dress rehearsal, we had Lee paint, and then last night was our second night, and okay. it was Yi. So they were both very different because they're unique artists.
This is true collaboration because you have artists from very different backgrounds, some of whom do not always understand the other discipline. I mean, actors don't understand dancers don't understand painters. But the fact that you can bring them all together on the same stage at the same time, telling the same story or parts of the same story or riffing on the same story is pretty remarkable. And some of the other people involved in this include Gina Stewart, who's a well-known performer in this area, Billy Ensley, Brenda Gamble, in a piece called Three that was written by another area actress, Catherine Goforth. It's about missing someone. I believe, Sarah, did you choreograph this piece?
I did, yes.
Describe it.
Well, this is a piece that I did want to leave very open for interpretation. It's about, you know, life's relationships and how someone has affected your life in the present and in the future. Mm-hmm. and beyond.
So that, so you took, let me ask how you developed this. This is from something written by Catherine Goforth.
It is.
Do you take it, look at that, decide what kind of music, what the tempo should be, what the music should be, how many people in the dance company? How do you begin?
That's a good question.
How do you eat an elephant?
It started with the idea, and then Catherine and the musicians and I would meet regularly and just kind of brainstorm about how we wanted this story to develop and what kind of vision I see and what they see and kind of see what ideas work together.
What makes this, I think, really unique, and that's I modified a word that can't be modified. You can't modify unique. But what makes this unique is that this, for Charlotte, is that this truly is, from the ground up, creativity. This is not something that you rent from Samuel French or Tams Whitmark. You're developing these pieces from the ground up, mm-hmm. in terms of the story, the writing, the music, the dance. Everything you see was developed right here,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty exciting. The other piece is one of yours, Till, Left Foot Smile, which I read a description of yesterday and did not understand. So you can elucidate that for me here.
Oh, well, no. I mean, I can't. Obviously, I can't give it away and tell you everything.
Okay, all right.
But it is, I think, a little bit what it's really about is, on the one hand, what it includes is bring a little bit of our experiences from Berlin over here. Mm-hmm. So, like, the music is all done by musicians from South Africa that have performed with us in Berlin. And, of course, it shows some of the influences of new things we have done over there.
Because you have this cultural exchange in your company in Berlin, mm-hmm. With
yes.
Canada and South Africa so far. Will there be, if this lasts over here, a cultural exchange like that going on?
That's
here?
What we hope for. I think that would be a wonderful thing also because there were a lot of very good artists in Charlotte, and I always felt that it still is like that. And there's an opportunity there to go out, that we would like to create that also, for them to come to a city like Berlin that is still a very, very interesting, vibrant place.
And will we see performers, artists from Berlin coming mm-hmm. over here, hopefully?
That's what we are all moving forwards, and okay. vice versa.
Moving Poets Reloaded runs through November 2nd at the Booth Playhouse at the Performing Arts Center. You can get tickets through Carolina Tix. Sarah Emery is the Charlotte Artistic Director, and the Berlin Artistic Director and founder of the company is Till Schmidt-Rimpler, a man whose name I like to say. Thank you for being here. Welcome back.
Thank you
very much.